This is Fresh Air. My guest is The New Yorker's new theater critic, John Lahr. Throughout his career, he's written about fame. He grew up watching what it's like to be famous. His father, Burt Lahr, was a star of burlesque, vaudeville, theater, and film. He was probably best known as the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz. John Lahr's first book was a biography of his father. His subsequent books have been about Noel Coward and the British playwright Joe Orton. The movie biography of Orton was based on Lahr's book Prick Up Your Ears. John Lahr writes, "When you are raised, as I was, in the household of a famous clown, you learn to recognize the genuine article." And Lahr says, "Barry Humphries is the real goods." Lahr's new book is about Humphries. Barry Humphries always performs before audiences as a woman in the character of Dame Edna Everidge, a housewife turned megastar who looks not unlike Margaret Thatcher.
I hope I've come to the end of my speculations about fame, but I think Dame Edna is who is a comic character, a housewife superstar, now megastar, is a satire on celebrity, and Barry Humphries, who plays the character, really sort of manages to send up celebrity and the sort of imperialism of it, you know. And I'm interested in it because I grew up in the household of a very famous comedian, and insofar as I am a public person, I've had to sort of deal with that in one way or another. And it's a way of dealing with some sort of internal quarrel one is having between private living and public performance, you know.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed Barry Humphries over the summer, and part of the reason why I did the interview is I liked your profile of him so much, and he seemed so articulate and so conscious of what he was doing as a performance artist.
Yes.
And then 5 minutes before the interview was to begin, I found out that he would only do the interview in persona as Dame Edna. And I kind of always nowadays refuse to do interviews with people who are in persona because I feel like I feel like a pointless straight man asking questions to a person who's a fictional character.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about Barry. Barry is, I think, now in his late 50s, has been a star in Australia and worked his way to stardom in Europe. It's phenomenal stardom. In Dame Edna Everidge and The Rise of Western Civilization, which is the book I've written about him, I chronicle him from backstage at the Drury Lane Theatre in London, which is the biggest theatre in London. And he was packing them in. He put 2,500 people a night. He was earning £180,000 a week. He's got an audience. People love him, and he's extraordinary. But the character is the repository for a lot of very, very vindictive, hilariously mean-spirited feelings, which Barry, as a sort of a bon vivant and, as he would admit, sort of a dandy, can't and isn't allowed in English society. When you move in English society, as he does, you're not allowed to talk about your work, your fame, or express a lot of hostility. You have to really keep it guarded, and Dame Edna is a wonderful sort of release for him, so he can pass in the world as a sort of gent while Dame Edna takes care of the rest.
You said that you thought you had come to the end of the period in which you were speculating on fame. What makes you think you've come to the end of it? And do you want to be at the end of it?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think that my work on this, I think the culture has caught up to me a little bit. I mean, I wrote a book in 1971 called The Autograph Hound, which was sort of partially co-opted by Martin Scorsese in his The King of Comedy. And the discussion has sort of gotten into the culture more. But I think that, you know, I think you stop wanting, if you grow and if you change. I moved in 1972 I moved to England to sort of convalesce from ambition and have stayed there, live there, really. And it's good. It's real. You can just follow the process and not and do your writing, which is the paramount thing, and do your living and not sort of live with the notion of an idea of yourself in the public mind, which is always is one of the sort of terminal problems of this culture.
In writing about the British playwright Joe Orton, you said the famous leave around them shattered lives. Did you feel that way about your father and his fame?
Well, yeah, it's not so spectacular, but I do think you discover, as if you are sentient and if you think about it and really probe it, that the price that the famous pay for their own celebrity is other people. their destiny is fulfilled at the price of family and connection and nurturing. And I sort of see now that the kind of narcissism that makes people perform, and I think that anybody in the arts across the board of any quality has to have a lot of that. There has to be an element of the show off. That narcissism is part of the package, and you come to understand it and forgive it. But nonetheless, I think that my father lost as much as we did by not being able to participate in our lives and being as self-involved as he was. It was also part of his greatness, so it swings in roundabouts. But as you get older, you understand it more, and you see how there's a knock-on effect of his behavior in the insecurities and problems that you face and have to work out in your own writing and living.
But of course, you've made your father part of your work, because one of your books, one of your best-known books, is a biography of him.
Absolutely. In a sense, it was nice. And it's a way of calling it quits with one's parent, in a way. It's the only way I could have gotten to know him was to write about him. It's the only way he would have talked to me about himself. And I spent 5 years writing that book, which I'm proud to say has never been out of print in 25 years.
It's a wonderful book.
It's sort of poetic to me that he did help launch me in that sense, and I sort of helped him stay alive in the public imagination over these last 2.5 decades, and that's nice. I mean, we were quits at the end. He died literally on the week I finished the book, and so he never read it. My ex-wife and I had a plan for dealing with his criticisms, because I doubt that he would have wanted the book that I wrote published. Although when he read the reviews, he would have been happy. So he didn't have any idea of what I was doing, and that it was serious, and it departed from all the kind of conventional sort of showbiz biographies that he would have read, you know, or known about. He wanted his golf scores printed, you know.
My guest is John Lahr. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is The New Yorker's new theater critic, John Lahr. His first book was a biography of his father, Burt Lahr. In writing about your book, Jeffrey Wolfe said that you explore the way sadness speaks to comic genius. Do you feel you understand the connection, having written about 5 books about people who were professionally funny?
Well, I guess it's a mystery that I'm drawn to, because the thing that I could never quite understand about my father was how incredibly glorious he was on stage and animated, and the minute he was off, he was morose and still. And there is that's what I'm after. That's what I'm after in Barry Humphrey's book, The Dame Edna and the Rise of Western Civilization, that kind of curious no man's land when an ordinary citizen moves into the limelight and in front of 2,000 people and thrills them. What happens? The chemistry, the metabolism, the shift in personality. That's a sort of mystery to me that I think I understand it better than many. But I've come to no definitive conclusions, if you see what I mean.
When you were a kid in the wings, watching your father and others go on stage, was there sometimes that kind of one moment of transition, where they'd go from, you know, the morose backstage person to the magnetic onstage person?
Well, with an old pro like my father, he could just sort of walk on, and that connection with the audience attention, brought him up. The fact that he could control them, that he was absolutely in control of them. When I was once backstage after he'd gotten a laugh on a conjunction. He'd said something like but or and the audience had fallen about. And he came off, and I said, Dad, how did you know that was funny? I mean, what told you that was funny? And he said, listen, I listened to the audience, and they told me where the joke was. And I wrote that down and didn't understand it for about 5 or 6 years until I actually got involved in the theater. And then I understood what a simple but profound thing that was, because he had such an intimate connection with an audience that he really could feel their need, and he could sort of move with them and improvise with them. And he was their kind of link to the play world. I mean, a perfectly example was in, say, Waiting for Godot, which he premiered on Broadway, I think in 1954. I might be wrong, 56. Anyway, where he sort of actually made a connection between what was then considered a very abstruse and phony play to the sort of real deep sense of loss and confusion, which he really felt and instinctively felt in the poetry of Beckett's play.
You recently became a New Yorker theater critic, so you're spending part of your time in the States and part of the time in London. What do you think are some of the big differences now between the theater scene in London and New York?
Well, as far as I can see, that there is no theater scene in New York. There's hardly a theater culture anymore. There's certainly no uptown theater scene to speak of. I mean, there's some exceptionally good. I mean, Jelly's Last Jam is a wonderful musical, and there are pockets of it. But there's no. It's a sad deterioration, even from the time that I was working as the drama critic of The Voice.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, a combination of money, demoralizing control of the Times over the tastes, the commercial tastes.
New York Times?
Sure. I think anybody who, I mean, it's not, I think that it's the paper, the idea that one paper controls the sort of, the sort of commercial destiny of apparently controls the commercial destiny of theater. I mean, there are pockets of things happening, and I'm finding a lot of interesting, talented people. But part of my brief, and one of the reasons, Tina Brown and I see eye to eye on this, is that when The New Yorker was started, there were 257 shows on Broadway, and they were building 7 new theaters. So there was a reason. The New Yorker drama critic had his job cut out for him in the city. Now, I don't know how many shows there are now, but there's got to be under 40 probably. And all bunched in, a large number of them bunched in February, March, and April, running up to the Tonys. So that my brief is to cover theater worldwide. I've been to L.A., Boston, Chicago, England. I'll probably go, I'll go where there's great theater. I'm really interested in seeing good theater and celebrating theater more than I am giving sort of snide notes to people after the fact, you know. I mean, I'm happy to be critical, but I'm more interested in theater culture and developing a sense of theater culture, which is fabulously interesting, than just cheap shots.
When you say there's no theater culture or not much of it left in New York anymore, what do you mean by theater culture?
Well, just that. A world where theater is exciting, where people are thinking about theater, where it matters to people, where the books are published, where you can go and talk and see, hear songs, hear stories. It's real. Even when I was around with my parents, who never came in earlier than 5 in the morning on any given night, they would, there was a, that would be Lindy's, or it would be the Store Club, or El Morocco, and there would be late night shows, and there was a much more avid interest in theatrical culture than there is now. Partially because a lot of the theatricals have decamped to L.A. in order to make a living, but that's the reality. And one of the things I'm going to be doing, another part of the job at The New Yorker, I think, is to sort of flush out what theater culture there is and write about that, which is not that's other than writing about plays, but the ticket takers, the people who service the what remains of the theater.
One last question: do you often end up going to the theater to review plays and end up in a theater that you remember from your childhood?
That's a good question. A lot of times, I mean, are you saying that do I remember, do theaters sort of haunt, am I haunted by certain theaters? And the answer to that is that sometimes yes. I remember going to see George M. at the Lowe's, I think it was the, where George M. was, I think it was on the Palladium, or I'm getting the theater wrong here, I'm sorry. But I was watching that, and I got very sad. Because the quality of performing was so much, the period was my father's period, and I had remember seeing the kind of tasty cavorting that my father and burlesque comedians like him did with an audience, and seeing this very sort of tame imitation, it made me a little blue. But no, I don't have the theater houses don't. I'm not nostalgic. I am looking for new forms and interested in how one of the great things about theater is, in a sense, it's the curator of the current English, that is to say, American language. So if you want to hear language, or hear, in a sense, you can hear it in its truest form in theater, I feel. And I am very interested in language and its permutations and development. You don't get it in television, where it's kind of, there's a kind of self-censorship, and certainly don't get it in films in quite the sort of vividness and experimental way that you do in theater. And I like the immediacy, the thrill of contact with something in space, you know, that's there, unrepeatable, joyous. And, you know, what was something my father taught me, which I like to think, at least I, in my writing, I can aspire to, which is that the real vaudevillian's gift of corrupting an audience with pleasure. It's something that is the theater teaches, and it's a good lesson to learn.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
A pleasure.
John Lahr is a theater critic for The New Yorker. His new book is Dame Edna Everage and the Rise of Western Civilization, Backstage with Barry Humphreys. This is Fresh Air.